baseball fans, and welcome to a podcast to be named later. I am your host, Chris Mitchell. We've got a lot to get to today here on the program, and I got to say I'm excited to be bringing in Sean McAdam from Comcast Sportsnet up here in Boston to talk a little bit of everything American League. We'll talk a little bit about the trade deadline. We'll touch on Chris Sale a little bit, but we're not going to talk about the insanity of Chris Sale. We're going to talk about the left arm, the possible contributions he can make if, and that is a big if he is traded to someone, and it sounds like he is a very hotly pursued member of the pitching community, but he's going to cost quite a bit of coin. So we'll talk a little bit about that. We'll also talk about the state of the Boston Red Sox here on the program. Sean McAdam is very good and very knowledgeable when it comes to everything baseball, but he specializes up here in Boston on the Red Sox. And so we'll talk about the recent trade of acquiring Drew Pomerantz, the recent trade also of Aroldis Chapman. I want to compare that to the trade for Craig Kimbrel, as well as the impact that Chapman may have being outside the division. Are the Yankees sellers, which I don't actually believe they're full-fledged sellers, but nonetheless, they're obviously looking to more towards 2017 than this season. But what will be the impact? All they do is shift Andrew Miller into the closer's role and move Dylan Betances back an inning. I don't know how the Yankees are destroyed by selling off this ship, and they got a pretty good return. So while I do think the Yankees are probably sellers in a much larger sense, I don't think that moving Chapman necessarily kills their chances. I just don't think the Yankees are much of a contender for that matter. But anyway, we'll talk about the Anderson Espinosa for Drew Pomeranz trade, as well as the Aroldis Chapman for Gleyber Torres and Billy McKinney trade there. We'll also talk a little bit about Mike Piazza. He was inducted into the Hall of Fame recently. We're not going to do a lot about the Hall of Fame. Ken Griffey Jr. also inducted. But I find it interesting. I was a little bit surprised that Piazza got in to begin with. For when you look at him and you look at all the different rumors and the things that are swirling around baseball these days, it surprised me a little bit that he got in. So we're not going to spend a lot of time talking about the Hall of Fame, but I want to do a little bit of general baseball business before we get into the trades and the American League and the trade deadline rumors. And the business I want to get into is Sean's opinion of Mike Piazza getting into the Hall of Fame. Again, the numbers are standout. But I remember specifically hearing about Jeff Kent. Jeff Kent was not really a second baseman in the sense that his defense was considered well below average. You could argue that maybe he was an average defensive second baseman, but the point being that the general opinion on Jeff Kent was that he was an offensive player and they just stuck him at second base, and that he was actually more of a negative defensively on his value. And yet, I don't remember Jeff Kent getting a lot of hype as a guy that absolutely should be a Hall of Famer. And yet you look at Mike Piazza, his defense was not only not even mediocre, it was probably downright terrible, but his offense obviously was standout. But when you look at Jeff Kent's numbers at second base and you look at Mike Piazza's numbers at catcher, they're both extremely standout offensive players and at best mediocre and maybe downright poor defensive players. And I don't see Jeff Kent as being a Hall of Famer or getting into the Hall of Fame, or at least he's not a unanimous Hall of Fame inductee, and yet Mike Piazza gets in this year, and there have been other rumors circulating. So I think Mike Piazza is an interesting topic. So while Sean isn't an expert on the Hall of Fame, I thought it's a timely topic to get into today. So that's the things we'll be discussing here on a podcast to be named later. If you want to follow me, Chris Mitchell, you can do that on Twitter, at CJMitch73. If you want to follow Sean, it's at Sean_McAdam. Over on Twitter. He does a great job when it comes to everything baseball, and we're going to be obviously talking with him today. Let me bring Sean into the program. Sean, always love having you on. I know we've got you in the car, so please be safe, but how's everything going on with you?
Very well, Chris. Nice to join you again.
Great to hear. Let me ask you about we're talking about a lot of things here on the program today. Let me just start. All right. Let me ask you first, before we get into the Red Sox and everything that I talked about there, let me just ask you real quickly about Mike Piazza. With the steroid rumors circling around him, and as I said, the defensive issues, were you surprised that Mike Piazza was a Hall of Famer, or did it seem to make sense? I heard on your program on the baseball show that you did not vote for him, but should he have been a Hall of Famer if there was no steroids? I'm just curious. The all-around story and the narrative of Mike Piazza, to me, it sums up that I was a little surprised he was a Hall of Famer at all. What are your thoughts about him getting in?
Well, I think if you look at the vote totals over the last few years, you could see that Piazza was trending toward probably being elected. It requires 75% or three quarters of the vote that particular year to make the Hall of Fame, and he was, you know, he had cracked the 50% and gotten up over 60, I believe, the year previous. So he was definitely heading that way. So I can't say it's a surprise. To me, he was a borderline candidate, a great offensive catcher, but not much of a catcher in the strictest sense. And I speak about his throwing ability, his receiving ability, all the things on the defensive side of the ball I thought were average at best. And then you throw in some, admittedly, these are suspicions about some PED use. You played with him, against him at the time. And I just had enough questions about whether he had performed cleanly, and given that I saw him as a borderline candidate in the first place, I chose not to vote for him. As I said also on the baseball show, I don't think it's a sin against the Hall of Fame that Mike Piazza is now in. I just didn't think it was an overwhelming, compelling enough case for me to vote, both for his candidacy and with some seriousness or some assuredness that he had the game cleanly.
Yeah, I think the Hall of Fame is such a tricky topic. I almost don't really even feel comfortable having an opinion. I think you should, and you have a vote, so obviously you research it a lot more than I do. I really don't, from my perspective, the only way I can evaluate Hall of Famers is really a feel, and I don't think that people should be voted in or kept out because they don't feel like a Hall of Famer. So when I talk about the Hall of Fame, I don't actually feel like I should have a strong opinion. I have questions, and I like to discuss it, but I think it's so difficult, and in this day and age, the goalposts seem to be even moving more with rumors of steroids and now defense becoming more and more important, and so it really is tricky. But again, my feel of it is that Mike Piazza getting in isn't a stunner, but it was a surprise, and yet he gets in, and congratulations to him. But the Hall of Fame is such a tricky topic, more maybe now than ever. Would you, since you started voting versus what you're doing now, is it a different world voting for the Hall of Fame than it used to be?
Oh, no question. I mean, it was always a challenge because it's an enormous responsibility. I always have and will always continue to treat it seriously. You know, I know there are people saying, well, you're sitting in judgment and you don't have 100% conclusive proof that someone did or didn't do that. That's true. I admit it is a subjective process. We try to, and I think the vast, vast majority of fellow voters try to vote their conscience and vote based on what they have seen. And there are naturally going to be differences of opinion on that. And that's part of the fun. For those who say that, you know, in the area of PED use, that I have no 100% proof that someone did or didn't, that's correct. But this isn't a court of law. I'm not trying to put somebody behind bars for something they did or didn't do. I'm merely making an informed judgment on whether I believe that a player achieved what his numbers reflect honestly and without the use of PEDs. So if that's flawed on my part, I'm guilty. The system is flawed. I wouldn't necessarily argue with that either. I don't know that there is a perfect system, so we try to do our best.
And to wrap it up, let me real quickly bring it back to a Boston topic and David Ortiz. His name appeared on one list that was leaked to, I believe, one reporter, and yet that's the one thing that everyone clings to when they try to argue against David Ortiz. But then you've also got the defensive metrics and how important that is becoming in these days, in the day of baseball. And also, I think it's going to play more and more of a role when it comes to the Hall of Fame. If you're a positive defensive player versus a negative, and obviously David Ortiz being a DH makes that even more tricky. Do you think that, the fact that David Ortiz appeared on a list is the most important reason why maybe he does or doesn't get in? A, I guess, do you think David Ortiz gets in? B, is that name being on that list a killer? Or is the fact he doesn't play defense even more of an impact? I'm just curious, with a Piazza getting in, and then eventually probably like you talked about on the baseball show this weekend, possible rumors or possibly even the revelation of some Hall of Famers actually finally admitting that they used. What are your thoughts on David Ortiz now that he's in his final year and we're 5 years away from possibly debating this issue?
Yeah, I think it's going to be a hotly contested name. I personally think that Ortiz's numbers, even acknowledging that the vast majority have come as the DH, make him unquestionably Hall of Fame worthy. I mean, you don't hit better than 500 home runs and coming up on 1,700 RBI and 290-plus batting average for his career, numerous MVP considerations, all-star teams, his postseason performance, which is one of those things that can help tip the scale in favor of a player. All of those, to me, make him absolutely a Hall of Fame candidate. The question that I struggle with, and I suspect others will as well, is what you referenced with the 2004 or provisional testing list. Ortiz continues to maintain that he doesn't know how that happened. He has made efforts to try to find out what, if indeed he tested positive for, what that was. There's been a lot of speculation. Again, my inclination is to not vote for those who have some PED ties, and that's unquestionably the case with David Ortiz. But it's a call that I don't have to make for five more years. Maybe circumstances change. Maybe there's evidence that comes forward in one way or another that either exonerates him or implicates him further. And so that's a judgment I'll make in 5 years.
And I'm interested to see what that happens, and I'm positive I'll ask you that question again over the next 9 months, never mind the next 5 years. So I look forward. I think that's an interesting topic. We're going to spend a lot of time on it today, but I did think Mike Piazza deserved at least a couple minutes of conversation, and I can't talk Hall of Fame without discussing David Ortiz. So that's our moment of business here on a podcast with Name Later. I'm Chris Mitchell. You can follow me on Twitter at CJMitch73. We're talking with Comcast SportsNet's Sean McAdam, baseball writer. You can follow him on Twitter as well. Highly recommend that you do, at Sean_McAdam. Sean, let's transition it back to the American League, and let's talk a little bit about the trades before we get into the Red Sox and the AL East and the pennant races and so forth. First, let me ask you about Anderson Espinosa and Drew Pomeranz. I think the argument for why this trade happened is pretty simple. And then the argument about whether it was a good or bad trade is really one without an answer. And for me, it's team control of Pomeranz, affordable contract, and the fact that Espinosa is probably 3 or 4 years away from being a contributor to a winner. To me, that's the simple argument about why this trade was done. If you can argue, well, Espinosa's too good or the Red Sox didn't get enough. I think those arguments could be made, but, I mean, I don't know how you make that evaluation. There's risk with Pomeranz, and there's very much unknown with Espinosa. And so while everyone can argue both sides of a very valid discussion, I don't know if we have an answer for that. What's your thoughts on the Anderson Espinosa for Drew Pomeranz trade?
Like you, I understand why it got made. There was clearly an urgent need to upgrade that rotation. There were only three dependable starters in Price, Wright, and Porcello, and that is allowing for the fact that Price has been a disappointment and underperformed. Still, he's someone that you have a long-term commitment to. Excuse me. And you would expect that his performance will eventually improve and be more in keeping with his career. Said there were two spots in that rotation where the Red Sox were regularly getting pummeled in the early innings, going into their bullpen, which in turn impacts the team for the next couple of days with reliever usage. They had to do something. They also knew that this was not a great free agent market this winter. It was not like a year ago where Price, Cueto and Greinke and others were available. There is no even close to front of the rotation type starter on the horizon in the free agent market this winter. So anything you were going to have to improve the rotation for next year would have required a trade. So to me, what the Red Sox did was essentially speed up the process, get somebody to not only help them in the short term in this pennant race, but for the next couple, as you mentioned. They control Pomerantz for two more seasons after this one. So that's the rationale. As you said, Chris, I think, you know, it may be 6-7 years before we can really assess who won this trade, because it's probably at the age of 18, I would say that Espinoza is probably 3 years away from getting to the big leagues, and then he's got to be given some time to adjust to the big leagues, and then you can see what kind of pitcher he has become at the big league level. To me, Pomerantz has a ceiling. He's not ever going to be a number one, certainly, and he may not even be a number two, but it looks like he can be a solid middle-of-the-rotation guy who isn't necessarily going to give you a lot of innings every time, but can be dominant in shorter spurts, may have some problems with pitch efficiency over the long term, but a guy who is at 27 just kind of figuring it out, and you're getting him for the prime of his career. So, you know, it's easy to make the case on each side for why each team did what it did. The Padres aren't going to compete anytime soon. They did a great job of trading someone that they gave up, Yonder Alonso, and another minor leaguer for only this past winter, and turned that into Anderson Espinoza. So A.J. Preller did a good job for the Padres. And if Drew Pomerantz pitches as well as he has for most of this season, Monday night included, then the Red Sox have themselves a dependable lefty reliever in the prime, lefty starter in the prime of his career.
And isn't it really a perfect storm for sellers of the starting pitching market? You don't have a top of the line David Price type who's on a 2 month rental, which 2 month rentals are usually affordable. We saw what Aroldis Chapman got for a reliever, so we can see how it would have been even more expensive if there was a starter out there that was a rental. But nonetheless, there aren't those impact guys at rental prices, and you've got these affordable young pitchers out there that maybe have issues, have risks, Teheran, Gray, and Pomerantz, but not only have they at times been really good, but they're also under affordable team control, which so many teams really covet these days. When you combine all of those factors, it's really a perfect storm for the Padres to be selling a Pomerantz. Isn't that part of it too?
Yeah, and as I said, particularly when you look back and see how little they gave up for him only this past off season. You know, they did, this is kind of like the real estate version of spinning off a house. You know, you buy on the cheap, hope that the market creates a factor where what you have is more, a lot more valuable than what you paid for it. That was certainly the case for the Padres.
And what did you think about the Aroldis Chapman trade? They bring in a Gelvis Torres and Billy McKinney. I don't think all that much of Billy McKinney, but he's, I guess, something of a meaningful piece. But really, the star of the headliner of that deal was Torres for a rental. And because it's a rental, you can't tag him with a qualifying offer. So that is even a more diminished return for the Cubs, unless they're, I mean, maybe they get that window of negotiation, I guess. But if you're following Keith Law, he doesn't believe that has any impact on whether you trade for a player or not. But in general, what did you think about the overall return of Chapman? And is it because the Cubs are kind of bound like the Red Sox? I talked about a perfect storm. You've also got a Red Sox team that has a great player in the final year of a phenomenal career. And it's almost like they feel like they had to go for it. He's also having an MVP season. The Cubs must be feeling the pressure of going to a World Series. Did that play part of it too? Or is that what an elite reliever costs these days? So therefore, if the Yankees wanted to sell Andrew Miller, they would actually get significantly more than what they got for Chapman.
Yeah, I think that's probably true, the last part of that statement, because you control Miller for two more years after this. And, yeah, he's expensive at $9 million or so. But, you know, would anyone argue that Andrew Miller is one of the, you know, 3 to 5 most dominant relief pitchers in the game, no matter where you use him? And that's the beauty, is that he is – a adaptable to pitching the seventh and eighth, as well as being able to close out, as we saw a year ago. So it doesn't surprise me that they haven't moved Miller. I don't think they will. They can certainly afford that 2 years, and in keeping Miller and Betances together, they at least have that. You don't have the triple threat anymore, but you got two guys to lock down games at the end, and you control them for a number of years. They could end up moving Beltran, who's also a free agent, but I don't see them moving Miller. But as to the Chapman deal, again, pretty easy to see what each side was thinking here. It was the Yankees' intention to move a valuable commodity at a time when it's unlikely, as good as Chapman is, that he's going to spell the difference between them making up ground in the wild card race or missing out on the playoffs. You know, they got him for very little because the Reds were dealing from a disadvantage after the negative publicity associated with the domestic violence case that he was involved in the offseason. So the Yankees paid about 50 cents on the dollar to get him, and just like the Padres did with Pomerantz, although under different circumstances, they spun around and sold at the top of the market. And, you know, for slightly more than two months of Aroldis Chapman that you're giving up, you're getting back a very highly thought of athletic shortstop who obviously is still a few years away. You know, debate whatever you want to say about McKinney, but he's fairly highly regarded and should be a major league player. And Adam Warren, who is a valuable swing guy and for whom they had given up Starlin Castro. So it's not like you got Starlin Castro for nothing from the Cubs. And on the Cubs side, this is obviously Theo saying, let's go for it. You know, we're right here. Let's stop waiting. This has been 108 years and counting. We still, if you're the Cubs, you're thinking you still have a very deep, and you didn't have to give up Schwarber. You didn't have to give up some guys who might be closer to contributing. You still have a lot of highly regarded prospects, so you didn't completely sacrifice the future here. And yet you got a guy who can just wipe teams out and lock down the ninth inning. And he'll be extra motivated to rebuild his own value this fall as he goes on in the free agent market. So, again, it's a matter of each team addressing some needs. The Yankees were about building for the future, and the Cubs are about going for it and trying to maximize what could be a historic season.
And Dave Dombrowski has been, I think, criticized for most of the trades he's accomplished in recent history. When you look at, I think, at least in Boston, I don't know nationally what the case may be, but in Boston, at least, it seems like a lot of people feel like Espinosa was too much to give up for Pomerantz. I remember that many people thought that the prospects given up for Craig Kimbrel were too much, and while I didn't think so, I think more people, at least in the Boston area, felt like, if you're going to give up those kind of quality prospects, you don't do it for a closer. You do it for something like maybe a starting pitcher or something like that. So it seems like he's being criticized for these deals and that he's giving away all of this prospect talent that Theo Epstein and Ben Charrington and Hazen have built up here. What does the Aroldis Chapman trade tell you about what Dombrowski paid for Kimbrel?
Well, it's hard to compare those two because the Red Sox say that they knew about the incident with Chapman when they were in the market for a closer. And frankly, I think all things being equal, well, I think at the time, the fact that you could control Kimbrel for two more seasons after this made, made him a more attractive trade piece. Even absent the whole question of what happened with Chapman in the offseason. You're talking about a guy who was on the final year of the deal or somebody in Kimbrel who was starting, you know, the first of three more years to a deal. So in terms of control, you're getting Kimbrel for three seasons and you were only getting Chapman for one. And then add in what they knew or say they knew at the time, which is why they traded for Kimbrel in the first place, that they didn't want to deal with the fallout for trading this guy, only to have the revelation come out that he had threatened his girlfriend and fired shots and police were called and whatever else happened that night. They deemed that to be a hot game out, and after the initial outrage kind of sets in, the Reds were in a position where they had to move him. They knew they were going to get next to nothing for him, and that's about what they got from the Yankees. Maybe the Yankees played this better because they didn't give up much for him, and they just were able to get a nice group of players and prospects in return after using him for 4 months. But the circumstances and the dynamic of that reliever closer market were very different last winter.
Yeah, and I think if you look at the way that the Dodgers handled this versus what the Yankees ended up having to pay in order to get him, the Red Sox may have been trying to spin that, but it sounds like they're actually being honest there, because the Dodgers ran from this and the Yankees swooped up and benefited from it. If the Reds were a little bit more prudent, they probably should have held on and kept him. But obviously they just wanted to be rid of that contract and move on. But it sounds like from what the Dodgers did, that the Red Sox concerns, if in fact that is an honest story, as far as the reports go, it sounds like those were legitimate concerns on the Red Sox part.
Yeah, I mean, we'll never know what the reaction would have been around here. I think it would have been considerable. There would have been a lot of criticism. Then the story breaks, and then the question becomes one of two things. Did you not do enough homework to know about this, or did you do homework and didn't care about it? And neither one of those scenarios would have been good for the Red Sox from a public relations, image, branding, however you want to place it. They would have had some questions to answer, and deservedly so. So they just decided, you know what, let's go get the other guy, and we can have him under control for 3 seasons instead of one, and we don't have the headache of dealing with this domestic violence accusation.
Yeah, you're either incompetent with your due diligence, or you were competent and careless and thoughtless for acquiring a guy who possibly did something very frowned upon in the world. It's definitely a difficult box to be put in. Let me ask you about the Red Sox here real quickly, the state of where they are. The Orioles got a 2.5 game lead in the AL East. The Orioles have won 5 in a row, while the Red Sox have lost 1. 58-40 for the Orioles, 55-42. The Jays are 56-44. They just acquired Melvin Upton here recently. I don't know if that really makes any difference in the standings, but they got some offensive depth nonetheless. What are your thoughts on where the Red Sox sit right now, and are they done? Should they be done? Or do they need to do more or a lot more in order to make David Ortiz's final season a successful one?
I think they've done a lot of good. I think it would behoove them to get one more pen arm to help out. I think there are a lot of unknowns in that bullpen at this point. The durability of Tozawa, whether Buihar is going to be much of a contributor, should he come back? And I think you don't know what you're going to get from Joe Kelly, and Monday night demonstrated that. So I think they should get one more arm. I think they've improved a lot over the last week, 2 weeks, with certainly with Pomerantz, Ziegler, Hill, and Martinez. The bench is better. The depth is better. The flexibility is better. The rotation certainly better. And I think the rotation, while not great, is now good enough to win. I think for the first time this season, you can say that every member of that starting rotation gives you a chance, not a guarantee, because those don't exist, but a chance to win every night. You're not holding your breath and watching the game between your fingers out of fear based on who the starter is anymore. They have 5 legitimate major league starters. And I think they're going to win the division. I think they are the best. I didn't believe that at the beginning of the year, but I do think it now. I still, frankly, do not understand where the Orioles, how the Orioles are where they are. Hats off to them, but I think there are defensive holes on that team, and there certainly are giant question marks about the rotation. I don't know that the bullpen and the lineup is going to be able to prop up that rotation all the way to the end. Toronto's got a lot of talent, but there are questions and injuries there that they're dealing with. I think it's going to be a good race all the way to the finish. But to me, on paper, the Red Sox are the team to beat.
Yeah, and this is a very inexact way to put it, but somehow it just seems like Buck Showalter gets more out of his team than almost any manager I can ever think of. And while I can't pinpoint why the Orioles are winning, the only thing I can look at is somehow Buck Showalter's teams outperform what they look like on paper. So I give him the credit with no good reason or fundamental argument for it. I just say, look, I have no clue. I throw up my hands kind of like you just did, and I say, Buck Showalter, there you go. And that's really the only way I can look at it. It's probably wrong, but I don't know how else to point either, because the Orioles for two or three straight years have pitched much better than I ever thought they would have and have performed much better than I ever thought they would.
Yeah, I agree. I'm not in the whole a huge Buck Showalter fan, because while I think he does things that make bad teams average and average teams good, I've yet to see him make a team great. He's never won a World Series. He's never won a pennant, for that matter. And I think there's a limit to, you know, again, this is not based on anything scientific, just based on observation and history, that there's a limit to how far teams go with him. But he can certainly make flawed teams competitive, and we've seen that in Baltimore for, as you said, the last few seasons.
Yeah, I agree. That's a good argument. And he kind of built up the Diamondbacks, but they didn't win with him. They got better. They got competitive. They got legitimate, but they never became World Series winners while he was there. So I think you definitely make a case there. Last question. I know you got to get going, and so we'll wrap it up here. But real quickly, if you were going to make an impact, Chris Archer, maybe, he's not pitching very well, but Chris Archer and Chris Sale are the two names out there that would cost an extraordinarily amount of prospect assets to acquire. But if Archer can pitch like he did in 2015 and Chris Sale's just Chris Sale, who's maybe the best pitcher in the American League, do you think those guys are legitimately available? And I look at it as available, but the price is enormous. I think the asking price is probably fair if you're a White Sox fan, but it's probably a price that nobody's going to be willing to pay. That's my read on it.
I agree with that theory, Chris. I think that the prices for both those guys, and probably more so with Sale, given what he's accomplished, have been set almost artificially high by the two franchises, as if to say, if anyone's dumb enough to give us this, we have to take it. But I don't know that that's going
to. Yep, and I think you have to ask for that. I mean, if you look at the White Sox, if they don't get a Nomar Mazara, a Jurickson Profar, and a Joey Gallo, are they really better over the next 3 years where they can contend if they don't get that kind of haul? So you might as well keep a guy, since pitching is so valuable, even if you're just going to continue to be mediocre. I mean, unless you definitely get better, it doesn't make sense to move a guy under the circumstances of Sale. So I think the price is reasonable to ask for, but it's just not reasonable for a Red Sox or whatever to go through with.
I think that's an accurate reading of it.
Sean McAdam from Comcast SportsNet. You can follow him on Twitter @Sean_McAdam. Sean, love talking baseball with you. Appreciate you taking the time today. Have a good night out there at the ballpark.
My pleasure, Chris. Thanks for having me on. Always enjoy it.
All right, that's Sean McAdam. You can always read him over at csnne.com. As I said, if you want to know where he's going to be, what he's talking about, you can always follow him on Twitter @Sean_McAdam. Love having him on the program. Always brings good insights into what's going on in the American League and also specifically the Boston Red Sox. I am your host, Chris Mitchell. This is a podcast to be named later. If you want to follow me, you can do that as well, @CJMitch73. If you want to read any of my baseball content, whether it be fantasy sports related or baseball related, you can head on over to rotoexperts.com, where I write about fantasy minor league prospects. Or you can read about my baseball content over at minorleagueball.com. If you want to join us, if you want to talk baseball with me just during the day, I'd love a reason to procrastinate. All I need is just the smallest, most minute reason, and I will do it. You can also talk with me over on Facebook. It's a podcast to be named later. And as I said, you can follow the podcast over at minorleagueball.com, where I have links to all of our podcasts. We've been talking to a lot of people every single week, whether it be about baseball, daily fantasy baseball, whether it be fantasy baseball. So we've been doing podcasts with Rob Nyer, Jim Callis, Vincent Lara from Baseball America. Sean McAdam comes on the program. We're going to have Chris Mitchell, not me, but Chris Mitchell from Fangraphs.com, who writes about prospects over there. We've got a lot of good guests. We're going to be talking with Rob Nyer on Thursday evening at 7 o'clock Eastern, so he'll be coming back onto the program. I'm also hoping to be having Joe Sheehan come onto the program and a lot more, a lot of other guests as well. I'm hoping to get Jay Jaffe on to talk a little bit about the Hall of Fame. I did a podcast with him during the winter talking about this Hall of Fame class. I'm going to have him hopefully back on if he's available. He's been pretty good about coming on. I'm hoping that I'll be able to get him back in the next couple of weeks. He's got to be busy with the Hall of Fame inductions just happening and people focusing a little bit on next year's class. So I'm hoping to have him on. We'll see if we get him or not. But I can let you know about that over on Twitter at CJMitch73. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. 30 minutes of baseball, everybody. Enjoy the remainder of the season. And again, I write a daily column or two over at minorleagueball.com. Today, I've just posted my article about who you should be watching for tonight. I do that every single day, or most days anyway, about who you should watch and why. So head on over to minorleagueball.com and catch that one, as well as my breakdown on things like the Drew Pomeranz trade and the trade deadline and things of that nature. Thanks, everybody. Be good and stay cool.